Well, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 491, another interview with Robert Perry being recorded on December 19th of the year 2004. Once again, it's my pleasure and privilege to bring to our airwaves Robert Perry, the author of, among other titles, Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. Robert, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you.
Last week we were talking about a number of things, including the Moon Organization, and you had recently been informed, I had just heard before going on the air, about the death of Gary Webb. Before we get into the subject of the Moon Organization and its position of great power within the Republican right in the current administration, did you have any thoughts about Gary Webb's passing? I want to reference for listeners a couple of eloquent and substantive articles on Robert's website, consortiumnews.com, about Gary Webb's life and work. Is there anything that you wanted to comment on air about Robert, or anything you wanted to develop further about either of those articles, or any other comment of any kind that you wanted to make about Gary Webb?
Well, I mean, no, I think, you know, it is a tragedy that Webb's career and life was pretty much destroyed because he tried to get out a tough story. I know some people felt that it was not done perfectly, and I suppose there always are quibbles you can have with any story, but the larger point of what he was getting at was the bringing the focus back on the Contra drug trafficking, which had occurred in the 1980s and which the Reagan-Bush administration had protected, was far, far more important than any quibbles over some details in his series. And instead of looking at the larger picture of the Reagan-Bush administration's guilt in putting geopolitics, in this case the war against the Sandinistas, ahead of serious and effective law enforcement of stopping cocaine trafficking where the Contras were involved, it's reached the point that should be the larger issue, not Gary Webb. But the sad thing was that the major news organizations, the Washington Post, the New York Times, and the LA Times, focused on Webb and tearing apart his series and then tearing him apart, and failed to really do their job with the American in regard to the American people and hold the Reagan-Bush administration accountable for these very serious crimes of state that were committed. In which the CIA finally did acknowledge that in the fall of 98, the CIA Inspector General acknowledged that more than 50 Contra units or individuals were implicated in the drug trade, that the U.S. government knew about this as early as 1981, that the Reagan-Bush administration did not take action against them, that it essentially protected them for public relations reasons, and that now, this was allowed to go on, and when people tried to stop it, whether law enforcement people or members of Congress or people in the media, they came under pretty fierce attack. The great tragedy is that the major newspapers really joined in those attacks, and to the degree that they destroyed Gary Webb's career, and even when the CIA admitted there was a lot of truth to the general allegations he was making, the newspapers never really made that clear. They never went back and fixed the record and helped Webb get his career back on track. So it was a pretty awful situation, and that if it contributed to his suicide, that's a very big black mark on American journalism.
Yeah, it is, and I also noted that the initial obituary reports, at least as carried in the San Jose Mercury, made a reference to self-inflicted gunshot wounds, plural. Then that changed, and I don't know if that was a typo or whether it was perhaps an indication of something else, but it's just
wounds, David. But that doesn't mean, you know, people are jumping to conclusions, and I think it's quite sad. I mean, I've communicated with his family. He rewrote two letters, one to his kids describing why he was taking this step. He made preparations. I know there's a lot of murder conspiracy stuff bubbling around on the internet, but obviously everything has to be checked out and looked at carefully, but it doesn't serve memory well to people to get carried away with conspiracy theories. It just kind of makes a joke of it all, and And I think, one has to be careful and look and see what the facts are. People should not get ahead of the facts.
Yeah, I know. I just thought I've been inundated with emails about that, and I did note that in passing. My own feeling is that what's significant here is that the man's career was murdered, you know, whether or not there was anything. But so he did, apparently he had, this does appear to have been a step that was considered and that he just basically had gotten really, really down and decided to end it, in your opinion.
Well, that's the way the family sees it, and some of his friends who did keep much closer tabs on him than I did. I've not really been in touch with him for some time, but he was apparently having money troubles, and he was apparently having to move, because that's why the movers were there.
Mm-hmm.
He told them not to come in, to get 911 instead. So I think the evidence points to suicide. I mean, again, one has to look at the facts and see where they lead, but but I think people should not just start making a circus out of this.
Yeah, I know, because I've just had people, you know, saying, almost accusing me of covering up Gary Webb's death because I haven't discussed his murder. Well, first of all, I just heard about it before, just before going on air last week to record our last interview, and, you know, again, I noted the obits, but you know, it would seem to me that anybody of good conscience, I'm editorializing a bit, but anybody of good conscience who had been through what he'd been through, and he'd also lost a job with the state of California, and with these very dark times, I mean, the second Bush administration doesn't figure to be a very good time for investigative reporting, and you noted in some of your articles for Consortium News that what would really appear to be at stake in connection with the 2004 presidential election is whether reality even matters to the American people.
Well, I think we are facing that problem where much of what we are being fed isn't true, and Americans don't seem to hold the government very accountable for that. The Bush administration sold them on weapons of mass destruction, and so did much of the media, and even when we now know, or should know, that they weren't found, we still see these remarkable polls where significant percentages of Americans are saying that weapons of mass destruction were found, or that Saddam Hussein was involved in 9/11. And there's almost a resistance, a kind of rejection of fact, a rejection of the whole empirical method of the age of reason.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost, it sounds like a number of Americans have sort of crossed over into this idea of that faith and belief trumps information. And obviously for journalists, that's not a very pleasant picture, because journalism is based on the concept of empiricism and examining the facts and following where they lead and not just believing things out of faith, that it goes against journalism. And so if we reach that stage that we now don't, a significant part of the population doesn't even care what the facts are, it is a dark time for journalism and for reason. And the age of reason is what gave birth to this country. It was what our founding fathers drew upon when they developed the concepts that essentially looked at the idea of giving more and more power to individuals and rights to individuals, compared to what was in existence in Europe at the time, where there was both the idea of the divine right of kings and the power of the churches and religions, which had led to a number of wars. So in the United States, we opted for a different course. But it really came out of this idea that reason and fact and empiricism would allow the government to function for the better interests of the people. And if we're moving in a direction that rejects that, then yes, we're in a, we probably have some very dark times ahead.
Yeah, and so all of which is to say that whatever the circumstances are concerning Gary's death, his career was certainly murdered, and these are times that are going to try, we'll update it, people's souls, particularly those people who do rely on, do have faith in the power of intellect and reason, as opposed to faith-based initiatives. How's that for a transition, Robert? One of the things we spoke about, and it's sort of, a transition element from the subject of Contra Cocaine, which, of course, Gary Webb was very heroic in covering, to an organization that wields tremendous power in this country and in the Republican right, the Moon Organization. which is something a lot of people are aware of. They know it's a cult, unquote, but it really is far, far more than a cult. It's a major power base with tremendous economic power, tremendous political power, and something which really isn't very well known. As sort of a transition element, let's very quickly review the cocaine coup, the Moon Organization's role in that, and how that spawned the contra-cocaine connection that Gary Webb so heroically explored.
Well, I think it even goes back a little farther, going back to the origins of the Moon Organization. The Moon was considered somewhat of an eccentric flake, even among some of the religious groups in South Korea. He had believed that he was the Messiah, and that his job was that Jesus had failed, and his job was to purify the human race. Initially by actually having intercourse with women, and he would the idea was blessing the womb. And this was got him in some trouble in his early days, where he was considered somewhat of a sex abuser, and that was how he was just basically a small cult leader. But he made some very important connections to South Korean intelligence. Some of the people who were forming the KCIA, maybe because of the women being available in Moon's cult, were attracted to it and saw its usefulness. And when South Korea began to develop its post-war relations, which took a while with Japan, since they've been bitter enemies during that time, part of that was that the introduction of Moon to some powerful people in Japan who ran the Yakuza crime syndicates, particularly Sasakawa and Kodama. And they also, those folks also were involved in anti-communist organizations, and Moon worked with them and formed the World Anti-Communist League, or at least made it into an important international force, along with Chiang Kai-shek and some other Asian leaders. So you always had this sort of organized crime component to this, to the Moon organization, at least with their associates. And when Moon moved on in the 70s to start operating in South America, he also hooked up with a number of right-wing elements, neo-Nazis in some ways, who also had gotten involved with both the heroin trade and the early cocaine trade, which was just beginning to develop as a drug of choice in that time frame. So in 1980, when some of these right-wing groups were trying to overthrow the government of Bolivia, they were working with the Argentine intelligence services. And the Moon Organization comes in with the World Anti-Communist League, and they help support and fund this coup in Bolivia, which involved some neo-Nazis and involved even old Nazis. Klaus Barbie was a figure in the coup. He had been working with Bolivian intelligence and joined the military folks in helping to overthrow the government. And it was very bloody, and a number of government officials were executed and tortured. And essentially, Bolivia was turned over to the cocaine industry. And it became the secure source of raw cocaine that was then shipped to a place called Medellin in Colombia. And that was the original source of cocaine for the Medellin cartel, at least, significant, very secure supply route for the cocaine. And of course, the Medellin cartel then pioneered this idea of how to make it into a big business and ship it heavily into the United States. So even at that early stage, some of the people who later became involved with the Contras, in particular the Argentine intelligence services, were hooked up here. And some of the Argentine intelligence officials who had helped with the cocaine coup and were involved in the money laundering for the cocaine trade moved on to Honduras and set up operations to help the Contras. This was the early stages of the Contra War in the 80-81 timeframe. And some of them later testified that they were involved in this, and that there was a testimony before the Kerry investigation in the latter part of the 1980s, where one of the Argentine officers described his role in conducting these operations and to using the money laundered through Miami to both fund the cocaine coup operation in Bolivia and then to help with the Contras. So you had, even in those very, very beginning stages, this corruption. And you also had Moon's role. I mean, Moon had sent one of his top lieutenants, Bohipak, to La Paz, the capital of Bolivia, to meet with the cocaine coup leaders, Bach said he raised a throne for Reverend Moon in the highest city in the Americas, La Paz. And so there was this very close relationship that continued for the early part of the 1980s between the Moon organization and the cocaine coup government of Bolivia. Moon also during this time was suddenly very flush with money. His organization had always been implicated in money laundering operations, and that had really gotten him into some trouble. He ended up, because of a congressional investigation in the 70s, into the so-called Koreagate affair, which was an influence buying scheme by the Korean government. One of the Korean government's conduits for that influence buying was the Moon organization, and that information then led in the early 80s to his indictment and prosecution on a tax evasion charge. But really, the core of it was that money was coming in that was not being properly handled, and the U.S. government in these investigations could not really track its source. This was money was being laundered into the United States and being put to use for political and other purposes. And so that's where we ended up, at least by that point, where Moon is very flush with cash. No one seems to know where it's coming from. He then opens up the Washington Times in 1982, which is an important element in what becomes the conservative news media, which in the early 80s was really just forming. It had, one could trace it back, a number of years, but by the late 1970s, there was a concerted effort by the conservative foundations to build up their own news media to counter what they saw as a liberal media, the Washington Post for Watergate and the New York Times for some of the CIA stories that had been done. So the idea was to build up that, and one of the big elements was the Washington Times, which gave the conservatives a daily outlet for their information and a way also to spread money around. In Washington, they would pay people for columns and for articles, and so they could put money in the pockets of some political figures. Moon also began setting up a number of political conferences and political groups that further spread money around. And some of the Republicans who saw the Republican Party as kind of his target were alarmed. People like Congressman Leach of Iowa had protested some of this and tried to make an issue out of it. The Rapon Society, which was more of a liberal or moderate group of Republicans, did a report that accused the Moon organization of trying to get control of the Republican Party. And when Leach had his news conference, one of the guys who showed up to sort of disrupt the news conference was a young Republican named Grover Norquist. And the Young Republicans was one of the groups that was being supported by Moon. And Norquist shows up to sort of start yelling and being disruptive at this press conference that Leach was holding. And of course, Norquist has since become a major Republican figure in Washington, one of the top advisor to House Speaker Gingrich during the Republican Revolution of the 90s, and to this day a very influential Republican with the Bush administration.
Interrupting very briefly, Robert, veteran listeners will recall a lot of discussion in the For the Record broadcast about Grover Norquist's Islamic Institute. It was basically part of the Republican ethnic outreach program, which in past years had brought in Nazi war criminals and collaborators from the Iron Guard and so forth. And in the wake of 2001, September 11, 2001, it eventually emerged that some of the people associated with Norquist's Islamic Institute were people who had connections to the Muslim Brotherhood, people who had connections to the Bank Al-Taqwa, which was founded by a former Third Reich intelligence agent, Youssef Nada, and which was, according to official investigations, the major repository for Al-Qaeda money. And yet, you talk about Teflon, it just doesn't seem that this kind of stuff sticks, that outrages beyond anything. Can you imagine I'm being extemporaneous here, but can you imagine if Bill Clinton or anybody connected with him had connections like that?
Well, obviously, if you have a megaphone, which is what the conservatives spent a lot of money building, it sure helps. And the Washington Times was a big part of that megaphone.
Yeah.
What we've seen since 82, and Moon put about $100 million a year into this. So these are not small figures. He, on the 10th anniversary of the Washington Times, Moon has estimated that his expenses on the newspaper was a bit, were, you know, amounted to $1 billion. So this is a huge investment in terms of Washington politics and how Washington was being shaped. And what Moon's organization did, what the Washington Times would do, that was really uncommon. People can criticize journalism, and obviously I have, and we all do. But very rarely, hardly ever, do you see news organizations plant stories designed to undermine a campaign of a political opponent. And Moon would plant, or his paper would plant, false stories about, say, Michael Dukakis having psychiatric care, Bill Clinton being a KGB operative. And they put these stories out, and while maybe much of the mainstream press would initially ignore them or think that's kind of weird, they'd be picked up in the larger and larger conservative echo chamber. They'd get repeated on radio shows. And so there was a, it was a way to put in into the public consciousness questions or doubts, kind of like psychological warfare, kind of, or disinformation, the kind of propaganda operations that an intelligence entity would conduct in a target country. That's what the CIA might do, for instance, in Chile or Guatemala.
Let me interrupt briefly, Robert. Two of the early people in the Moon organization that you write about in Secrecy and Privilege were Reiji Sasakawa and Yoshio Kadama, both of them not only Japanese war criminals, but people who played a prominent role in post-war Japan and the Moon organization. Kadama, in his obituary in 1984, was written up as being arguably the CIA's most important contact in their main man, so to speak, in Japan. And you also, in Secrecy and Privilege, talk about a 1992 documentary about the Moon organization called Moon Rising. And in a program that's archived on Real Audio called From Kennebunkport to Pearl Harbor, Bush, Moon, and the Rising Sun, I feature an interview with Daniel Junis, who was featured on that program, and he voiced the opinion, echoing some earlier research on mine, that actually the Moon organization in many ways was the projection of the Japanese patriotic and ultra-nationalist societies, their primary vehicle for imperial expansion and also for the rise of fascism in Japan, down through the ages, so to speak, and around the world. And Kadama was actually a protege of a very important figure in Japanese clandestine politics named Mitsuru Toyama, the prime mover behind the Japanese Black Ocean and Black Dragon Society. So for veteran listeners, again, you can access that program, and when you hear Robert talking about how these are characteristic of psychological warfare campaigns, indeed the heritage of this organization is at one with the types of institutions that do that. Go ahead, Robert.
All right, but you also have, in the case of the Moon organization, very suspicious money that was being brought in to quite clearly influence the American political process. No one really knows where Moon's money comes from. I mean, it's not from the carnation sales that people might be more familiar with. Those actually haven't been happening for a long time. Some people say, oh, he sells pagodas to widows in Japan. Well, I suppose so, but it's, the real money has never been explained, and his involvement with organized crime figures has to raise doubts. But there's no question that he has been involved in money laundering. He I think that was sort of one of the points that his backers in Japan and South Korea understood, that especially in the United States, we afford religious organizations a great deal of latitude for obvious reasons. We believe in freedom of religion. So if you come in under the rubric of a religious organization, you're not going to get some of the scrutiny that you might if you just came in as a corporation or some other kind of business entity. So that's what they used, and often they would send in church members who would bring in large sums of cash, not declared through customs, and then funneled into the Moon organization, which had literally hundreds of companies. And so the money would be laundered through them. And in Secrecy and Privilege, I cite some new information about people who took part in these operations, who describe them from firsthand knowledge. But there also was a book done by Nan Suk Hong, who was better known as Nan Suk Moon, who was Moon's daughter-in-law. She had married his oldest son, and had had this horrible experience with the son, who was a cocaine addict and quite abusive. And she finally fled the family and wrote a book and gave affidavits in court relating to her experiences. And she has described firsthand also how she, on the instructions of Moon's wife, took part in these money laundering operations where she would hide money as they were coming in, not declare them with customs, and then put them into these organizations, which include funding things like the Washington Times. So there's strong evidence that the Washington Times and its political influence is, at least in part, supported by laundered money, illegally brought in money. And what Moon has been able to achieve with this is also protection. Because of his effective use of attacking mostly Democrats and liberals, he has been afforded by the Reagan-Bush administrations and now the current Bush administration a great deal of leeway and protection. The investigations of Moon that sort of reached into the early 80s pretty much stopped. And I also recount cases where I've obtained documents out of the federal government where American citizens plaintively have been sending letters to the Justice Department saying, why aren't these activities of Moon's organization being investigated? And there are all kinds of excuses that the Reagan-Bush administration would provide. One came from Robert Mueller, who then was a senior justice official, and now, of course, he's the FBI director. And he offered some excuse about because Moon had gotten a green card, and there always were reasons why they felt that Moon could not be investigated. Despite this firsthand evidence of continuing criminal activity. So what Moon gets is protection. And he worked closely with the Contras in the 1980s. He provided protection for them in a public relations sense when questions about their drug trafficking first surfaced in 85 and 86. And when Senator John Kerry investigated, Moon's newspaper led the attacks on those investigations. Essentially trying to get even some of Kerry's investigators investigating themselves, accusing them of obstructing justice because they supposedly got in the way of what the Reagan-Bush administration was trying to do. So there were all these pressures that Moon helped bring against people who were investigating these areas, which were very significant criminal matters. And so we ended up with a situation that some of these investigations could not go forward, or went forward much more tepidly than they would have, because of the political and public relations pressure Moon could bring on them. That, of course, was in league with what the Reagan-Bush administration wanted, too, because they wanted the Contras protected. And that leads into these ongoing cover-ups that went on really into the 90s of trying to prevent people from recognizing that the Contras had gotten themselves deeply involved in the cocaine trade in the United States.
Robert, we will pick this up on the other side of this broadcast. We've been speaking with Robert Perry, the author of, among other titles, Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. For people considering last-minute holiday gift shopping, that would be something to evaluate. We'll be joining Robert Perry again on the second side of this broadcast. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record Program 491, another interview with Robert Perry, being recorded on December 19th of 2004. For Robert Perry, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening. Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 491, another interview with Robert Perry. And again, it's my pleasure and privilege to bring back to our airways once again Robert Perry, the author of, among other titles, Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq. That will be the primary focal point of our discussion in this program. Robert, welcome back once again to our airways.
Thank you, Dan.
We're talking about the Moon Organization, its tremendous influence within the Republican right wing, within the current administration, and some of its history. I wonder if I, perhaps as a way of kicking things off, Robert, because a lot of people think of the Moon Organization as some sort of weird Christian organization. Other people think of it as a cult, but I'm afraid that the realities are far more serious and far deeper than that. You present some very striking quotes in Secrecy and Privilege that I think incorporate the Moon attitude towards America in a way that is not generally well known, perhaps even to veteran listeners to this audience. I wonder if I could prevail on you to read the last paragraph on page 239 of Secrecy and Privilege about Moon's attitude towards this country and its government and its people.
Well, Moon, in Secrecy and Privilege, Moon would often talk about how he actually viewed the American people, and his overall opinion was that he was supposed to rule the world. It was supposed to be that everyone was supposed to bow to Reverend Moon, and that he would provide a sort of certainly a theocratic rule. And it was almost like something like the rapture, where he would be the ruler of the entire world. And he in this section, in one speech to his followers, Moon boasted that, quote, without knowing it, even President Reagan is being guided by Father Moon. He says history will make the position of Reverend Moon clear, and his enemies, the American population and government, will bow down to him. That is Father's tactic, the natural subjugation of the American government and population. Although Moon is sometimes called a conservative, he doesn't believe in any kind of freedom. He doesn't believe in any freedom for anybody. He's supposed to be the religious ruler under what he calls Godism. And that means that no one has any rights. You sort of see this in his organization, where initially he would there was even the idea that he would have sexual intercourse with women, and that they would then have to have sexual intercourse with other men as a way to spread what he considered the way to spread the purification of the human race. That has gotten to be more refined into this idea that he would pick your spouse, that he would be a matchmaker, he would take people who didn't know each other and have them be married, and he'd have these big mass marriages, and he would bless them in that way. And he would even tell them when they could have sex and when they would have to procreate. When he had total control over their lives in even the most intimate ways. And that's what he has really envisioned for everybody. And he's been sort of bitterly disappointed that not more Americans have joined with him in this operation. And that has led him over the years to become increasingly bitter about the United States, at least in his speeches that he gives to his followers, which are often posted on the Internet so people can actually access them, but they have never received much attention.
And again, this is the organization that is wielding tremendous influence within not only the United States as a whole, but this flag-waving, allegedly patriotic administration. And Moon's views for the American population, the American government, I think, would be anathema to even some pretty reactionary Americans. I don't know if it's immediately handy, Robert, but also you make a remarkable quote from Reverend Moon about hamburgers and how satanic America is. Do you have that immediately handy?
Right. Well, there was basically Moon, as you say, did use the flag waving. He would promote himself as very much a lover of America in public, and there was one big rally he held in Washington with a number of flags, and he has shown that to recruits even years later, to try to show them that he, or to mislead them into thinking that they're being patriotic in joining the Moon Organization. And one person he recruited through these techniques was a New York University freshman named John Stacy in the 1990s. And Stacy rose to be a fairly significant figure in the sort of the youth movement of Moon's organizations, and was part of many of the meetings and had direct contacts with Moon himself. And I interviewed Stacy after he left, and he was still pretty shaky when I interviewed him. He'd left only a month or two before. And I had this long interview with him in New Jersey where his family lived. And he discussed how he reached the point of breaking with Moon, and here's what he said. He was having a meeting with Moon in Anchorage, Alaska in 1995 at a leadership conference. He says, Reverend Moon looked at me straight in the eye and said, America is satanic. America is so satanic that even hamburgers should be considered evil because they come from America. Stacy said he thought, hamburgers, my father was a butcher, so that bothered me. I started feeling that I was betraying my country. In the church, it's very anti-Jesus, Stacy said. Jesus failed miserably. He died a lonely death. Reverend Moon is the hero that comes and saves pathetic Jesus. Reverend Moon is better than God. That's why I left the Moonies, because it started to feel like idolatry. He's promoting idolatry. And so that was the view of someone who actually had risen fairly quickly into a point of some leadership in the organization. But it's the kind of comment I received from a lot of folks who had been pulled into the Moon organization, often because they're idealistic or confused or having some kind of trauma in their lives. And often the recruiting techniques were fairly cult-like, where they would be isolated from family members, and they would be bombarded with the Moon message, and eventually broken down and turned into kind of robotic figures. And their families, of course, would be very distressed. But the Moon organization had built itself that way. However, it's also used other means, which are perhaps more practical these days, which is basically Moon has used money to invest in political figures and buy protection and buy influence. One of the people that he's given large sums of money to, certainly in the hundreds of thousands, and one person set up to $10 million, was former President George H.W. Bush, who continues to give speeches on Moon's behalf. And even Barbara Bush, the mother of the current president, has been part of those efforts to get money from the Moon organization. So, I mean, it's a way for Moon to both show he's powerful because he has these important people around him, and also to buy influence with them by giving them, in the old-fashioned way, by giving them money.
Review for us Jerry Falwell's benefits at the hand of Moon.
Well, Falwell, of course, is a sort of typical case. Many of the conservatives fell into Moon's orbit when they were having financial troubles, because Moon had this seemingly unlimited amount of money. And in talking to conservatives, they don't really want to know where the money comes from, because they think they might know the answer. They're concerned that it's been money laundered in the United States illegally. They're aware, at least dimly, of Moon's unsavory connections in South America and Asia. They probably, down deep, wonder if it is drug money. It's certainly one of the likely sources, original sources at least, of some of the money, even if his main role is to launder it, not to actually deal in those direct illegal ways. So you have all this money coming in, but conservatives have found it very useful, especially when they're desperate, to turn to Moon. In the case of Falwell, he had sold a number of bonds to build Liberty University, which is a Christian right school in southwestern Virginia, and he was on the verge of bankruptcy with it. I was able to find through IRS records that one of Moon's organizations had then given a couple $1 million to a nonprofit also in southwestern Virginia, run by two people who in turn turned around and bought up the debt that was on the verge of going bad for Falwell and for Liberty University, and basically forgave him this debt. And what they did is because the debt was being sold at such a fraction of its original worth, they were able to buy up a significant amount of Liberty University's debt and then hand it back to Falwell to forgive. So Liberty University was saved by this money, and the money came indirectly from the Moon organization. The losers in this were these well-meaning Christians who had, especially in Texas, who had been approached with these bonds to help support Liberty University. So they bought these bonds and then eventually sold them for only a fraction of their value. And they ended up going back to Falwell through this circuitous route. So Falwell made out very well. But the original source of the money that saved him was the Moon organization.
I guess one could say that God helps those who help themselves, huh? And he was helping himself. One of the early investigations into the Moon organization was the Korea Gate investigation, or so dubbed by the popular press. Tell us about that, Tongson Park, and what was the ultimate disposition of Congressman Fraser's investigation?
Well, as you noted, in the latter part of the 1970s, Congressman Frazier conducted an investigation into South Korea's efforts to buy influence in the U.S. government. South Korea obviously was very dependent on U.S. military protection. Its government was concerned, especially after Vietnam, that the U.S. might lose interest in doing so. If you remember at the time, President Carter was even talking about reducing the numbers of American troops stationed in South Korea. So that's the backdrop. And what happened was the Korean CIA, the KCIA, set about, and the U.S. government intercepted many of their messages, to use different organizations in the United States to buy influence. And they were going to target the media. They were going to target the Congress, and they were going to target academia in the United States. And so they began various programs to provide money, support for members of Congress. They even provided women who were made available to some members of Congress. The most prominent South Korean figure was Tung Sun Park, who was a bit of a playboy, or at least the person who was able to show people a good time and had them over, had politicians over to a fancy club in Georgetown, and used those kinds of methods to build some influence. But what the Frazier investigation also discovered was that another less known tentacle of this operation was the Moon Organization. And so Frazier and his investigators were the first ones to sort of put together how Moon had developed as an entity of Korean intelligence, and how Korean intelligence had put Moon in touch with key figures in Japan, who provided him money, and some of them were involved with the Yakuza crime family, and how Moon then was able to bring money into the United States and spread it around. Interestingly, the three targets of Moon's organization have been Congress, or the political system, the media through the Washington Times and through a number of media conference organizations that he sets up, and academia. He was involved in investing in schools, including Bridgeport University in Connecticut. So you have Moon essentially seeming to execute a plan that the U.S. government found was part of a scheme put together by Korean intelligence. And this was exposed in the late 70s, but a number of right-wing groups, including Terry Dolan, who was then running something called NICPAC, went after Frazier, attacked him, tried to find irregularities in his investigation, which is sort of a practice we've seen over and over again, where these attackers will zero in on little tiny mistakes. You know, in the case of Frazier, he had given some advances to some people who had come to work for his committee, and that's technically not supposed to happen. You're supposed to wait till they've done the work. But, you know, it's common in business, but it was that kind of thing they went after and tried to put Frazier on the defensive, that he was accused of being a communist sympathizer, and he was trying to run for another office in Minnesota and lost. And so Moon was able to eliminate one of his adversaries in a technique that we have seen now repeated over and over and over again, which has in a sense changed how U.S. politics works.
Veteran listeners will recall early discussion of the Moon Organization from a wonderful book called Gifts of Deceit by the late Robert Bocher, who was Congressman Frazier's aide in the Koreagate scandal, by the way, overseen and to a certain extent attenuated by Leon Jaworski, the Watergate special prosecutor. Robert Bocher wrote a very good book called Gifts of Deceit about the Moon Organization, tracing its history and many of the things that you touched on. Then later he, in something that's sort of reminiscent in some ways of Gary Webb's passing, he went off the roof of a building in New York City, whether he jumped, fell, or was pushed. I don't think there was ever any formal finding in that investigation, but it's just a disturbing footnote to this. In recent presidential campaign, there was one of a number of media blitzkriegs, so to speak, against John Kerry, was the Sinclair Broadcasting Network's echoing of the Swift boat veterans. And somebody who had gone to, one of the things that you related on the consortiumnews.com website was that a guy named Carlton Sherwood, who was a primary figure in the Sinclair Broadcasting attack on Kerry, also had previously been something of a spear carrier for Reverend Moon. Tell us about Carlton Sherwood, how he figures into Sinclair Broadcasting, and what he did on behalf of Moon.
Well, Carlton Sherwood was one of these figures in the early 1980s, mid-1980s, who came to the defense of Reverend Moon. Moon at the time, you know, because of the investigation that Frazier had done, some of that material was then turned over to prosecutors. They rather bravely went through and prosecuted Moon on a tax case, because they, even though they felt it was a broader money laundering case, they narrowed it to a tax case. Moon's conservative defenders started rallying to his defense and saying he's being persecuted. Carlton Sherwood, who then went to work for Moon at the Washington Times, did perhaps the most comprehensive defense of Moon, an attack on both the Frazier investigation and on the prosecutors who were involved in prosecuting Moon up in New York for the tax case. There are elements of this book are rather absurd, where Sherwood claims he was allowed to review all of Moon's financial records and that he found nothing untoward, which obviously is just not feasible. Moon's financial records are extraordinarily complicated and spread all over the world.
Well, one of the things you note in your book is that the organizations use a technique called smurfing, in which couriers, often Japanese women, would bring in huge amounts of cash. I mean, there's no possible way to trace it.
Right. Much of Moon's operation was a cash operation. So even if you looked at, not that you could look at all the records in any one place, but even if you could, they wouldn't show up, all these women carrying large sums of money to various banks. There was one very famous case in Uruguay where Moon had a bank, and these women would come in and deposit, millions of dollars over several days.
In cash.
But anyway, the book was an effort to give Moon some protection, to make him seem like he was being persecuted, and to put on the defensive anyone who would criticize him. So Carlton Sherwood had that history. Later on, his book was republished, I think, by Regnery. There were allegations in the early 1990s that the Moon organization had promised to buy 100,000 copies, which obviously would have made it a very profitable book for Regnery prior to Regnery republishing it. So you have, and I must say, whether, and there's some question whether or not that those payments were made, but that is the kind of operation that Moon would do, where he would find ways to get money into your pocket, but often not directly. It would either go through a front group, or go for speech, or maybe he would buy a building that you were trying to unload. He would find ways to get you money, and that's sort of his MO. So it was certainly fit with that, although I think Gregory has denied that that's how it was done. But anyway, the book was published and was used to whitewash Moon's role in these influence buying operations. And Carlton Sherwood then surfaces this past year, having done a documentary attacking Kerry, essentially calling John Kerry a traitor. And that was the documentary that the Sinclair broadcasting system wanted to air, and was going to order all its stations across the country to put this on. It was considered such a piece of propaganda and so unfair that stockholders at Sinclair rebelled and tried to get Sinclair to back off. Sinclair ultimately broadcast elements of the documentary, but not the documentary in its entirety.
And it's interesting, too, to ruminate about the labeling of John Kerry as a traitor. It's one of the reasons I wanted you to read that quote from page 239, where Moon's talking about how he's going to subjugate his enemies, the American government and the American people. I mean, if that's patriotism, I'd hate to say treason. One of the things you talk about, too, in Secrecy and Privilege, and the Moon organization fits into this, but the larger control of American political perception through the media and their ability, the Republican right's ability to simply annihilate opposition, either using legal entanglements or simply a propaganda blitzkrieg that ultimately will end in the political career of anybody who gets in the way. Not unlike in certain ways what I think the media did with Gary Webb. But I wonder if during the closing minutes of our interview here you would expound on that, because it appears that one of the ways that Moon really has been able to weigh in as a major American power broker.
Well, I think there's no question about that. He has pretty much all the smear campaigns that you can think of run, especially against Democratic presidential nominees in recent times. The Washington Times has either played a primary or a secondary role in, whether it be trying to present Michael Dukakis as someone who was under psychiatric care, a story that was so false that the reporter whose name was put on it, Gene Grabowski, resigned over it. But it still was put in play. Ronald Reagan then called Dukakis a cripple. And so it was something that was talked about and raised doubts about Dukakis, even if it wasn't true. The same was true in 92 with Clinton as a KGB agent, supposedly, according to Moon's organization. Another thing that wasn't backed up, but just kind of thrown out there to raise doubts. In 96, and of course during the Clinton years, the Moon's group pushed many of the rather scurrilous attacks about raising suggestions of Clinton being involved in murders and other kinds of nefarious activities. So it was a way to always put those in play. In 2000, it was involved directly in the attacks on Gore, raising questions of whether Gore was delusional. Gore was, of course, accused of making false statements, in some cases, as I show in Secrecy and Privilege. It was really a case of the media misquoting Gore and then not wanting to make corrections and allowing then places like the Washington Times to run with the misquotes. One of the more famous ones was about the Love Canal case, where Gore was quoted as saying that I was the one that started it all, but he never said that. He was referring to another case similar, and he said that was the one that started it all. And the Washington Times, of course, was not concerned about trying to get the quote corrected. It was interested in putting out stories about Gore being delusional. Those things had effects. I mean, they were, especially since by the time we get to the late 90s, the conservative media is so big and so powerful. It's got not just a newspaper and some magazines, it's got talk radio, it's got Fox News, it certainly has the Wall Street Journal editorial pages, it has a lot of columnists all across the country. So it was something that if you put these stories in play, they would get repeated to the point that many Americans would believe them. And much of how we saw also when we get into the Bush administration, the second Bush administration, these kinds of stories about weapons of mass destruction and attacking people like Scott Ritter, who was one of the guys who questioned those allegations by the Bush administration, was also deemed a traitor. So by putting these kinds of stories out and getting them into this conservative echo chamber, people, especially if they're just average citizens, in effect, someone like a Scott Ritter or a Gary Webb, these are people who do not have a lot of protections. They can see their lives ruined. And politicians, even with the protections that politicians would have, they have seen their reputations ruined. So it's a very intimidating aspect of operating in Washington. And, I've been attacked through the Washington Times when I was trying to do stories about the Contra drugs in the 1980s and on trying to expose Oliver North's secret operations. Brian Barger, my partner at AP, and I came under attack from the Washington Times on the front page. And that's an intimidating thing, especially when people don't understand fully that the Washington Times is not really a newspaper. It's a propaganda vehicle. People assume that it must be a regular newspaper. It looks like a newspaper. And many of the stories are pretty straight. So when they throw one in that is really disinformation or smear operation, people don't necessarily know that. So it's become a way for Moon to really exercise power and provide a great service to the conservative movement in Washington and the Republicans in particular. And now, of course, it's because the conservative press corps has gotten so large, it's much easier. And people are just unwilling to take them on because they know that if they do, their livelihoods may be lost in trying to just act like citizens and say, here's what the facts are, here's what we found. If you're a journalist or if you're a politician or a congressional investigator or someone in the federal government is whistleblowing, you can come under attack by these people and they will ruin your life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the money that came in, whatever the source, this mysterious money coming in from South America and Asia through the money laundering techniques of the Moon Organization, has had a real effect on how American politics works. And Americans don't really understand the full import of all of it. They think of it, as you say, they think of Moon as kind of a quirky, weird cult guy, perhaps. But the Washington Times insists that it's, quote, independent of Moon. But it's not really. I mean, it may not be out there proselytizing for his church, but it is a way for him to exercise power. And it's a way for him to ensure protection of his operations, which include not just religious stuff, but include these various nefarious business activities that should be investigated by the U.S. government, but are not being investigated because he's got so many protectors.
Well, Robert, unfortunately, you and ConsortiumNews.com don't have access to those huge rivers of cash. However, this is the holiday. We're nearing the end of the holiday gift-giving season, and you have a number of things that are available for modest amounts of cash. Tell us about your website. Tell us about how to get the book.
Well, ConsortiumNews.com is something that I started almost a decade ago as a way to get information stories out that the major media, which I've been part of, just weren't doing anymore. And it includes like some of long series we did on Reverend Moon. But it covers the whole gamut of investigative type topics. So people can go there. It's a free website. If people want to donate, they certainly are welcome to. We do provide that, possibility at the site. And also you can go through the site and click to our book page. We do sell Secrecy and Privilege, the new book I wrote that came out in September. And there are copies also of Lost History, the Contra Cocaine book that has a lot about Gary Webb's case. We also have Trick or Treason, which is sort of a narrative that I did on my PBS investigation of the 1980 election and allegations that the Republicans worked behind the scenes to undercut President Carter's hostage negotiations during that time frame. So those are all available, and people can also read a number of, I think, interesting stories about both current politics and some historical issues.
And listeners should also be aware that the For the Record programs are being archived on Real Audio by sister station WFMU. Go to the website www.wfmu.org/Dave Emory, one word, DaveEmory, and you'll be able to listen till time indeterminate to these various interviews that I've done with Robert Perry and the other For the Record shows. Also remember www.spitfirelist.com. That's the Spitfire website with written descriptions of the broadcasts and other material available as well. We've been speaking with Robert Perry, the author of, among other titles, Secrecy and Privilege, The Rise of the Bush Dynasty from Watergate to Iraq, currently available. This concludes Side 2, For the Record program number 491, another interview with Robert Perry being recorded on December 19th of the year 2004. For Robert Perry, this is Dave Emery saying happy holidays and so long.